In the third Aliyah of Vayeshev. And just before we start, just want to make reference to two great Talmidei Chachamim who passed away within the past week, both of whom I will, as Hashem, be referencing over the course of our discussion of this Aliyah. So we'll mention them when it comes up. But just to begin with and to note who we're referencing, so last week, as we mentioned earlier, we lost Rav Shlomo Fischer. Shlomo Fischer is a tremendous gaon of Yerushalayim, of Eretz Yisrael, and I was privileged to hear many shiurim from him during my time there, and certainly to learn from his svarim. His svarim go by the title Beis Yishai. He has two volumes of his shiurim, which are quite amazing and quite impressive, and two volumes of the drashos also both go by the title Beis Yishai, which we'll reference a little bit this morning. And it had a tremendous impact on many talmidim. And yesterday, following Shira, I went to the Levaya of another great Gaon who I was acquainted with personally and used to visit frequently and correspond with and talk to over the course of many decades, Rabbi Yishmayahu Shulman, who in later years worked as a stockbroker, but over his entire life was devoted to learning with tremendous bikiyas and hasmada and knowledge of all types. And he wrote many svarim over the course of his life. I have with us here the Sefer on Chumash, Meresh Bibira, which I'll make reference to as well over the course of this Aliyah. Apparently, he was 98 years old. Apparently, he had been a Talmud of Ner Yisrael in his youth, where he was known as perhaps the best of the Talmudim in Ner Yisrael. And in the Haskama to his first Sefer, Ruderman wrote that he was the first of the American-born Mechaber Svarim. So all the svarim written by Americans owe a debt to his trailblazing, and he wrote many such svarim, and so we'll reference that as well today. So just we'll have in mind over the course of today's year the neshamas of these two great Talmidei Chachamim and teachers of Torah and Mechabrim, of Shlomo Fischer, Zichet Tzadik Lebracha, and Rabbi Yishmayahu Shulman, Zichet Tzadik Lebracha. And just before beginning, just a note that this Aliyah tells us about Bechiras Yosef. And among the points that Rav Fischer makes, happens to have here a whole drush about Mechiras Yosef, which we'll try to refer to probably just very briefly, just to be aware. But he also has posited, and we know that the Tanaisim that we have are correlated to events surrounding the Churban, connected to the Beis HaMikdash. But we also have a tradition that many of these Tanaisim also connect to events earlier, to events in Chumash. So Tisha B'Av, it's about the Churban HaBayis, but it's also about the Chayit HaMeraglim. And Shavuot B'Tammuz is also about the Shvira Saluchos. So Rav Fischer discussed what was the events of Asar B'Tavis, what happened on Asar B'Tavis. So he suggests, he can't prove it 100%, but he thinks that Asar B'Tavis was the date of Mechiras Yosef. And of course that had a tremendous impact, as Meshech Chachma points out, that whenever we talk about an Avera Ben Adam L'Makom, and we discuss how to do tshuva, so we look to the Chet Egel as the paradigmatic Chet Ben Adam L'Makom, but whenever we look to a Avera Ben Adam L'Chavero and discuss how to come back from that, so the Chet of Mechiras Yosef is invoked as representing that Chet. And Rav Fischer in this address over here talks about how they may actually be interrelated, and he discusses at length, I'll have to let you read it on your own, but he discusses the possible connections between the Chet Egel and the Mechiras Yosef, and why there is particular significance to each of them and how they connect to each other. And that's itself a very fascinating discussion, in addition to this theory that there is a connection to Asar B'Tavis. I'll say in a more lighthearted note, just because I can't resist, it could bring a little bit of a proof that it was around the time of Asar B'Tavis, because the pasuk in the first Aliyah says V'yasifu od snow, so apparently it was a winter time. Okay, so with that, sorry, I just couldn't resist that, but just to move into the third Aliyah now. So here we have right off some very significant synergy, and I don't know if you had a chance, and not synergy to our sugya as much as synergy to the calendar. If you had a chance to look at the Gemara in Shabbos, which talks about the first pasuk in, or second pasuk rather, in this Aliyah, just to begin. The Valiya tells us, Vahi Kasher Bo Yosef Elachav, we have Shituas Yosef, Eskutanto, Eskasonas Hapasim Asher Olav. So the brothers attacked Yosef basically, and they took off his coat. One coat, or two coats, a little bit of discussion, but okay, took off his coat, and what did they do? V'yikachuhu v'yashlichu so habara. And they threw him into the pit. And here is the key line, v'habor reik, ein bo mayim. So the bor is empty, and it also doesn't have water. So the Gemara in Masech HaShabbos, right in the middle of the Chanukah sugyas, and Daf Chav Beis and Aleph, maybe you had a chance to take a look, tells us, what does it mean to say that it was empty, but it did have, it also didn't have water? So the Gemara understands that it means it was empty of the water, but it did have other things, and specifically nechashim v'akravim yeshbo, that there were snakes and there were scorpions there, and that is significant. The Ritva writes that the Torah is telling us this so that we should know that there was a nace that was taking place. Some suggest that Reuven, who didn't know about this, it must be that he trusted in his own, in the tzidkus, rather, of Yosef, that he would survive. And that's why the Torah says that he intended to save him, because otherwise it's a question, the language of Laman Hitzilu, if there was indeed such danger down there. So that was itself a discussion. And the Ramban notes that the brothers didn't know, or they would realize what a schus he had to be saved from such a setting. So the fact that this is invoked in the context of the sugyas of Chanukah, specifically the Gemara telling us the din, that a menorah that is more than 20 amos high is no good. So that's itself very interesting. Why is there, what's the relationship between the two? How does this randomly show up there in the context of our upcoming festival next week? So that there are many, many suggestions to. And Torah Tamima comments to highlight the fact that 20 amos is too high for a menorah, because that's beyond the point where you can see, that you're not going to look more than 20 amos up, and you're not going to see what's there. So too, the pit was beyond the point where they could see the snakes. And that if the brothers had seen that Yosef would survive being there with snakes, then they would know that Hashem was with him, and they wouldn't have sold him. And this is definitely a nace, because the Gemara tells us in the Maseches Yevamos, and Daf Kuf Chof Aleph, that if someone falls into a pit that has snakes in it, so then you can testify about him that he's dead. His wife can remarry. And this is to emphasize that you see that if he was able to survive in such a setting, so that was already supernatural. That was God's providence that could allow that to happen. And say for Yalkut Yehoshua, he suggests that this extra statement, combined with the Gemara about menorah, is to tell us that it's not just that people don't look 20 amos high, they also don't look 20 amos below. They don't look down. So not just 20 amos, but in general, they don't look down. So therefore, the Gemara also has there the din of a menorah less than 3 tefachim as a reflection of that fact. And the Meshul Chachma, so he has a very fascinating analysis of the relationship between Chanukah, really Chanukah overall, and this particular din, this particular interpretation of the story, actually. So he notes that the Gemara Maseches Brachos and Daf Nidalet Amud Aleph writes that if you encounter a place where a miracle happened to you, so you should recite a bracha, but it has to be a miracle that is supernatural. It has to be outside of the Teva. It has to be a Nes Nigla. So he draws the comparison here that when it comes to Yosef specifically, so we're told that Yosef eventually came back to the bor and he made a bracha on the nes. And the Meshech Chachma explains that the real nes was Yosef's survival and thriving in Mitzrayim and being put in a position to help everyone. So that was miraculous. But that was more of a nes nister. That was something that you could say that just happened based on politics or based on how people interacted. So it's not the kind of nes you can make a bracha on. So he goes to this location where we see that if he survived the coexisting there with snakes and scorpions. So that has to be miraculous. That's something which is enough to testify the person is no longer alive if they've gone through that experience. So because he had that kind of an ace, so that certainly does deserve a bracha. And that bracha is able to reflect upon everything that happened, even those less obvious miracles, which wouldn't necessarily qualify for a bracha on its own. He's able to have that in mind. And that's essentially really the whole theme of Hanukkah. And we'll speak about this a little bit more. But the whole notion that we have two miracles associated with Hanukkah. We have the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, and we also have the miracle of the war, the military victory. And the truth is that the military victory is a much more significant miracle. That's what is affecting us at Yom HaZeh. And if you listen, if you read Al HaNisim, which is crucial because Al HaNisim is how we express our Hodah every day of Hanukkah in our tefillah and our benching. So we don't make any reference to Pach HaShemen. We only talk about the war. But on the other hand, the Pach HaShemen is a more overt kind of miracle. And there are those who understand, and Maharal has a comment like this as well, that there's a relationship between the two, that we really want to be moda on the mochama, but we use the Pach HaShemen as the hook, because that's a more undeniably miraculous kind of thing, the idea of this oil lasting 8 days when it only should have lasted one. And that's what the Mesh HaChachma says. That's essentially the parallel here, that Yosef is using this overt miracle of being saved from this unsurvivable pit to be the bracha for his salvation, really having in mind everything that happened in Mitzrayim after that. And so too, the Pach HaShemen is the overt miracle which Hanukkah is associated with in order to acknowledge that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind everything and that that's what we are giving Hodah for. Other Sfarim have other comments here, just to mention a few of them. There really are quite a lot. There's a lot written about the whole derivation here in the Sefer Birkas David. He writes that the nature of this whole limud here is that the Torah is criticizing the brothers. So you would think that they checked that there shouldn't be any sakana to him. So to see only that there's no water, he's not going to drown, but they didn't see the snakes. So that's a criticism of them. So he writes, so why is the Torah emphasizing this extra criticism? It's interesting, just parenthetically, it happens to be a discussion in this parasha also, about which is something that happens all over the Torah, but just specifically it is written in this context, that Yaakov Kamenetsky in his comments in Parshas Vayeshev talks about why the Torah will tell us negative things about some of the people in the Torah, and why is that not a concern of Lashon Hara, and he discusses how it has the Musar value, and also whether it applies to people who are no longer alive. It's a whole discussion of itself. But so here, just kind of building on that, here's an additional negative idea about them, that they didn't check to make sure that there weren't any snakes. So the Birkas David writes that, yes, so we wouldn't necessarily want to know that, except that there's Pirsum HaNisa, like Hanukkah, that we need to publicize that Yosef was saved even from that, and that's worth it. And therefore, because of the need of Pirsum HaNisa, so this is what is emphasized. The Kli Yoker happens to write that the brothers knew that there were snakes there, a different perspective, but they felt that that was a punishment for Lashon Hara. They thought that Yosef was in violation of Lashon Hara against them. And as the Yerushalayim Torah writes, that the Nachash symbolizes a punishment for Lashon Hara. The Gemara, Maseches Tainis and Maseches Erechin compares the Lashon Hara to a snake, Baal HaLashon. And therefore, on one hand, there is this onesh for Lashon Hara that he should have snakes. But he goes on to say that since Yosef was actually not speaking Lashon Hara unjustifiably, but it was Lashon Hara l'toeles, so therefore he gets off with just the pachad, just the fear of the idea of being bit by a snake. Now, just to allude to this briefly, because it's maybe a theme throughout the parasha, but it's more explicit at the beginning of the parasha, so just mention quickly that there is a big debate in the commentaries in general about the pasuk in the very beginning of the parasha, where it tells us Ve'yaveh Yosef es divasam ro'al avihem, that Yosef spoke badly about his brothers. It's the second reference now to Lashon Hara about the brothers. The Torah says bad things about the brothers, and Yosef said bad things about the brothers. So what about Yosef saying bad things? So isn't that an avera of Lashon Hara? So there are different attitudes about this in the Mefarshim, from Rashi to the Chafetz Chaim and others before and after, that there are those who are critical of Yosef and who do feel like he was in violation of Lashon Hara on some level, while there are others who defend Yosef. And if you want to see a very fascinating Dvar Torah Lahalacha, there's a sefer called Afikayam. Afikayam was written by Yechiel Michal Rabinowitz, who was an associate of Reb Chaim Brisker. He was a contemporary of Reb Chaim, and he was a friend of his. And in his sefer Afikayam, it's mostly all lumdus, but in the very beginning, I think of the second chelek, he has a little Dvar Torah that's published there, like on the inside front cover. It's just a little random Dvar Torah by itself. And he comments that he takes the position that Yosef was justified. You have to assume that if he was speaking Lashon Hara, there must have been a good reason, because what was Yosef's last name?
Hatzadik.
So presumably, if he was speaking Lashon Hara, it must have been for a good reason. It wouldn't be stam that he was a gossip. So he assumes it was Lashon Hara L'Toelas. And the idea of it being L'Toelas, interesting. So sometimes L'Toelas, the most basic example of Lashon Hara L'Toelas, is when you're warning somebody who is at risk of harm from another. So Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, to protect somebody from being harmed, you tell them that something's going to happen. We spoke about this a little bit in the context of eavesdropping. When, under what context could that be permitted if it was itself an aspect of Lashon Hara? So Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa is the most obvious hefter for Toelas. But the Toelas here would be of a different kind. The assumption that the brothers were misbehaving in various ways, and that he needed to tell on them, essentially. He needed to go to the authority figure, in this case, Yaakov, to tell him to control them, to get them to stop misbehaving, however that was the case. So if that indeed was the Toelas, so what the Afikayam has there, it's a very fascinating idea, just to mention quickly, that it says there are three rules for Toelas. Now, this itself is a debate. The Chafetz Chaim has between 5 and 7 rules for Toelas. He has 2 different lists, where he has the whole checklist of different factors you have to consider when you want to decide if it's permissible or obligatory to say something negative. While Chazon Ish thought it was more one basic idea, is it the Toelas? So the Afikayam, he's in between, he has three rules. So what are the three rules? He says you can learn all the three rules from the Psukim in the beginning of Vayeshev. And that, just to mention quickly, so what are the three rules? So he says, first of all, you could say that he should have just spoken to the brothers directly. Why do you have to tell on that? So the Pasuk emphasizes, V'hunar espenei bilo v'espenei zilpa, that he was a brat in their eyes, that he wasn't going to have any influence, and therefore there was no option other than to go straight to the top. So that's the first rule. There has to be no other way. This is your only path, and you can't solve the problem without it. The second rule, those languages Vayave Yosef, that Yosef brought their bad reports. So there's so many different words in Hebrew for speech. So Yave is a very unusual way to connote that something is being spoken. So why is that the language? So he suggests that the imagery there is that when you're carrying something, you pick it up, you put it down, it's the same thing, it doesn't change. So too, here Yosef was delivering the reports, just the facts. There's no spin, there's no editorializing, there's nothing extra. So that's the message also. Second rule, if you're going to say something with Toelas, it has to be purely factual and without extra opinion or commentary or anything beyond that which is clearly factual. And the third rule, he says, is that the language is interesting. Ve'avei Yosef es dibasam ra el avihem, to their father. If you get into a fight with your brother and you say you're going to tell on him, what do you say? I'm going to tell your father on you? You say, I'm going to tell daddy. I'm going to tell Abba. So why would you say their father? Yaakov was also his father. So he suggests that if you can, sorry?
It was without emotion.
It was
not out of emotion. It was
emotion?
As in, when I get in a fight with my sibling and I, like, I'm going to tell Abba, that's because I'm, like, angry at them. Uh-huh. Whereas this is
that's
not.
Interesting. I thought you said something else, which is actually what he says, although that's interesting also. So I thought you were saying without a motive. Because that's
my point. Like, without a... As in, you're not no gea b'dama.
So that's what he emphasizes, that Yosef was not thinking at all that he'll score more points as the favorite child. That he was not going to look for any kind of a side benefit. So he was speaking to Yaakov only as Yaakov's role as Abihem, as the father of the brothers, the person who could make a difference. The fact that he was also Aviv, and that maybe Yosef would get some extra points by telling on his brothers and looking better in comparison, that wasn't a part of it at all. So, okay, so this was a big discussion, and many Mefarshim have different angles on this, whether Yosef bore any kind of guilt, or was it totally justified, or was it somewhere in the middle, in terms of speaking Lashon Hara about his brothers. So that's what the Kli Yakar discusses over here, that maybe there's some sense of an onesh, that the snake represents the Medaber Lashon Hara, but he survived the snakes because he had the justification. And he also notes there that Chazal had the understanding that the brothers thought they had justification for what they were doing here. They saw him as a rodef, but this is ultimately that justification was missing, which is a point that we'll come back to. So it says there's no mayim, it says there's no Torah. So he reads it homiletically, and it says there was no water, but there were snakes. So water represents Torah, but there wasn't Torah, was lacking in that sense, even though they felt it was justified. But there was a snake, so a snake, the Gemara in Seches Yuma, used to represent revenge. That Gemara has a phrase of no king, but no ter kenachash, to take revenge like a snake. So they were thinking about revenge, they didn't have water. They had the snake of revenge, they didn't have the water of Torah. That's another interpretation. The Sfas Emes, just in terms of the limud here, writes that the whole way to derive where had Chazal knew that reik ein bo mayim means no water but yet snakes, says that is a miyur achar miyut. So miyur achar miyut comes the rabbo, so that comes also to include the snakes, and he says that that's also significant because if there was a water, that would save from snakes, as the Gemara indicates. And they have an idea like this also in the Das Zakenim. He says, how do you know that there were snakes? Because so reik means that there was something there, and living things move. The Oznayim LaTorah also adds here that the Torah is telling you that good things you should say explicitly, and bad things bermiza. So the good thing that it was empty of other things, so that's said explicitly, but the bad things that it's not totally good news, so that is being said as a remez. There are many, many, many other explanations that are offered about the connection to this Hanukkah, B'derech HaPilpul. If you are interested in reading a lot about this, so there is a sefer you can find in HebrewBooks.org called Kovetz Mefarshim on Masechta Shabbos, which collects a lot of Achronim. So if you look on Daf Chav Beis, where this Gemara is, you can find many, many pages of fascinating Pilpulim about how you could derive extra connections between Hanukkah and the Menorah of 20 Amos, or Hanukkah in general, and this idea of Yosef and the pit. So just call your attention to it. Okay, so just to look a little bit at the next pasuk. So the pasuk says, "And vayeshu lecho lechem, vayisu enayim vayiru, v'hinei orchus yishme'elim boi migilad, ugmaleihem noisim, nechos, v'tzri, v'alot, holchim lahur mitzrayimah." So they sat down to eat, and they looked up, and here's the whole chevra of Yishma'elim. They're coming from Gilad, and they have their camels with all kinds of spices in them. So why do we care what was the load? Why do we care what the cargo was? So Rashi quotes the Chazal that this is to show the schar to tzaddikim that this at least was a pleasant smell. And Yosef had that special schus that at least he should have a transportation into slavery with a pleasant smell. So that's kind of fascinating, because you would think, okay, that's not really the focus here. That doesn't seem to be so much of a consolation. So Chaim Shmulevitz has a drasha here. You see that every little bit makes a difference, that even when somebody is suffering to any degree that you can reduce it, so that is significant, and every degree of kapara is relevant, and that's something to pay attention to. So even like the shtikal hakov, a little bit that's good, even among other bad things, is very clutch, very important to be cognizant of. Okay, so the next pasuk tells us that Vayomer Yehuda Lechav Matbetza Kinara Gesachinu V'chisinu Asdamo. Says, what benefit is there? What value is there if we're going to kill our brother and cover up his blood? So here, there is a lot to discuss, and those who were with us for the skills cover we had earlier in the morning, we looked at this Gemara in much more detail, but I'll just make briefer reference now, that the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin on that Vav makes reference to this Pasuk in the context of a discussion of Pshara. So Pshara is often translated as compromise. That may not be an adequate translation, but the Gemara has this whole discussion that when you have a Din Torah, so there is the possibility of asking for absolute din, absolute justice, or there's also the possibility that the parties can agree to pshara, and maybe the dayanim should encourage it. So the Gemara, in the context of getting to that point, first considers that maybe pshara is a bad thing, and it makes reference to this pasuk, and the Gemara quotes the pasuk in Tehillim, that botzei berech neitz Hashem, that somebody who blesses a botzeya, which in this context seems to mean a compromiser. It's a little interesting to try to chart the path of the translation in a different context. We did a little bit of that this morning. But roughly speaking, that seems to be the connotation. So somebody who is a compromiser, so that's a bad thing, and whoever praises him is blasphemizing, apparently is taking away from the integrity of a Kadosh Baruch Hu and his insistence on pure justice. So that's a very interesting idea. The Torah Tamima notes that it sounds like that we're supposed to see Yehuda as wrong in this context, and that therefore he's criticized for his compromising. Rashi and the Gemara over there explains that Yehuda could have done much more. That Yehuda, once he saw that his brothers were listening to him, that he had influence, so he shouldn't have been satisfied with stopping short. He should have actually saved them in the full sense and brought them all the way home. However, as much as that might be a possibility, so the Torah Tamima still suggests that ultimately Yehuda still had some concerns here that he wouldn't be listened to, and he felt that he had to make a difficult call. And the Meshech Chachma talks about this at length as well. And there's a lot to try to figure out about what exactly the message is here. And Pshara, ultimately, the Gemara concludes, is a good thing, and that the Beis Din should be encouraged to ask for Pshara. They should be encouraged to encourage Pshara, and that it's something which is connected with Shalom, Mishpat Sheyesh Bo Shalom, and it's considered Emes at the same time, and therefore it's a good thing. But the whole path that maybe there's something to question about Pshara, about Bitzua, and that Yehuda is invoked in a negative context is something which is interesting and meaningful as well. And Rav Nevensal, in his Sichos, has a long Sicha about this in this week's Parsha. It's also very kedai to read, where he goes through the whole question of good Psharas and bad Psharas, and they're not all the same. And that when we talk about a Pshara in the context of Beis Din, this is something that Rav Soloveitchik emphasized in his Shiurim. And I just participated in a podcast together with Rabbi Yomi Rishlita, talking about an article by Rassam Nachman Goldberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who wrote about Pshara, where we discussed the whole notion that Pshara gets a bad rap sometimes because people see Pshara as a compromise in a negative sense, meaning a kind of a watered-down approach that's unfair to the one who's quote-unquote really right, that they just split the difference and that there isn't really any justice to it. And it's clear from the Makoros, and Soloveitchik emphasized this in his Shiurim to Maseches Sanhedrin, that a pshara is not simply a split-the-difference kind of compromise. A genuine pshara, which requires a qualified Beis Din, whatever that means, b'zman hazeh, and requires an actual process, and maybe even requires more than regular din, because you have to have a unanimous Beis Din, according to Tosfos. So the notion of a pshara is that it's not simply a split-the-difference kind of compromise, but it's a very thought-out and careful process of din that, as the Rav put it, it's a din shalifnim mishur sadin. It's a din that also factors in the considerations that go beyond the strict letter of the law, but are also just in and of themselves. And when we have a pshara of that nature, so then that is the highest level. That's gevaldik. That's a din that is all-encompassing of every factor that is relevant to a just solution. This article by Razam Nechembe that we discussed in the podcast was recently published in English and Tradition. It was translated into English and published in Tradition just now. there, Rav Zalman Nechemiah points out all of the various aspects of justice that can be accomplished through pshara that strict din, for whatever technical reason, is not able always to accomplish. And therefore, pshara is more effective in bringing out a fully just result. So we shouldn't see it as a compromise in the negative sense. So when the Gemara has a back and forth about this, it's not that one position is completely rejected. It reflects the fact that there are different types of psharas and bitsuas in life. And some of them are very praiseworthy and represent the highest of merging MS with Shalom and bringing in all the different factors of within the Shur Sadin and Din and represent really a more perfect justice. And some of them are indeed inadequate, and one has to be wary and be very thoughtful. And this is the theme of Rav Devenstahl's essay, of just the fact that there are good pshars and there are bad pshars, and that we have to be able to recognize that and appreciate that. This is on our minds again. The United States is engaged in another negotiation with Iran, as it was a number of years ago, and the fear of Israel and much of the world is that they'll engage in a bad deal, in a pshara that's, whatever you want to call it, that's in a betzia, that's not going to be effective for what needs to happen. So then that's worse than nothing. So you have to have a sense of when it's something that is going to really be effective and really accomplish in an all-encompassing way what you couldn't accomplish otherwise, or is it going to be the opposite? Is it going to fall short when you could have done more? And to recognize that potential possibility. And he, in that context, also ends up talking about Hanukkah, to connect to that as well, and that he says the point of the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, which we could have said, as some of the Achronim ask, seems to be unnecessary, because we have a klal tumo hitra b'tzibur, that if you don't have tar oil, they could have used tummy oil. So why do they even need the whole miracle? It's a discussion of Yeshua, and everybody after him discusses. So Rav Devenstahl talks about there that it's to send a message to political leaders. He says that in matters of this nature, you shouldn't assume it's impossible and say, okay, we'll be okay with the b'dieved, we'll be okay with whatever we can get, but recognize that sometimes you have to push for the whole package, and that is what the moment asks for. So that's something also to focus on and to be aware. So the Paras Yosef over here, just to go back to the language of the Pasuk of Mabetza, so what do we gain from killing him? So he notes that why would you kill somebody ever? What are the motives for murder? He says there are three kinds of motives. One is profit, people get paid or they're somehow going to benefit. Another is nekama. And another is to send a message. So these people shouldn't mess with you. So you want to scare other people off. So he notes here that all three, Yehuda is saying that all the three normal motives we're not going to accomplish. He says, my bet, so he's not going to get any profit by doing this. We're going to kill our brother. So how can we take revenge against our brother? The purpose of revenge is not affected if we kill our own brother. Like the Yerushalmi has a mashal that the whole issue of Nekima in general, which the Torah emphasizes against the people of your nation. So the Yerushalmi has a mashal that taking revenge against another Jew is like if you accidentally hit your head with your hand, so now you're going to take revenge against your hand. So it's not going to help. You're just going to hurt your hand also.
You're going to spite your face.
Essentially, yeah. I guess that's what the expression means. So the point being that if we're all one entity, so what are you going to take revenge for? So you're saying that to take revenge against our brother, what's the point? And if the thing is we want to scare off other people who may challenge us, so Chisino es Damo, we're going to cover him up anyway. No one's going to know. So all the three motives he's expressing are not going to be fulfilled for this, so let's not do it. The Yad HaMelech, in a Sefer Tehillos Sanhedrin, that he writes that Yehuda's taina and the brothers was that if indeed it's true that they were done him, that he was chayiv misa, that they felt that this was legitimate, so then why be so secretive? We know that when they have Haruge Bezdin, so then it's publicized. And if you really believe that what you're doing is legitimate and justified, so then what's the point in hiding? And that's his objection. Okay. So instead, what does he say to do? L'chuv v'nim kerenu l'yishma'ilim v'yadeinu al tivo ki'achinu v'sareinuhu v'yishmu echav. So let's go sell them to these yishma'ilim and let's not touch himself, and after they listen. So what does the next pasuk tell us? So that's a big discussion. Ve'avru anashim mejanim socharim, ve'yimshuchu ve'yalu es Yosef ben habor, ve'yimkru es Yosef v'yishme'elim, ve'estrim kasef ye'aviu es Yosef mitzrayim. So there is a discussion in the Rishonim, the Rashbam and others mentioned in our previous session, that it's not really clear who it is who did the selling. Was this the Yishmaelim who took him out? Or was it people who passed by who took him out and sold him to the Yishmaelim? So was it Yosef's brothers? So this is a discussion, and it's noteworthy overall. Certainly all of our liturgy, including the Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur rather, and on the like, we talk about the legacy of the Mechiras Yosef that is attributed to the brothers. So there is some tension in the various sources as to the guilt of the brothers in the Mechira and the guilt of all the brothers. And here's where I'll refer to that in the Sefer Merish Bevira of Rabbi Shulman, Shulman Lebracha, Shmaya Shulman. He has a discussion about this, a brief discussion. He had a much shorter style than Shlomo Fischer, so the trade-off takes less time to read, but it's harder to figure out. But he talks here a little bit about that question, and he notes some of the conflicting sources, particularly regarding Levi, who in some sources seems to be exempted from the guilt here and held as if he was not the one who did this, but in other sources, Levi and his descendants clearly are considered to be liable and responsible for what happened. And he suggests that that may connect to this whole question, the assumption that they were justified and that they had come to some conclusion that this was what should happen. So maybe there were different levels of Lashma in that consideration. So to the extent that Levi was exempted, so maybe he was more Lashma in his assessment, whether it was fair or not, but at least it was something that came from an honest place, while still he was a participant nonetheless, and therefore there are consequences for that. And to a certain extent, it also suggests that the language that you find in the Gezerah, so that this is a Kadosh Baruch Hu's declaration, whether or not it's something we can understand, that maybe it reflects that tension, that, you know, they're guilty or they're not guilty. So to the extent that they're not guilty, or to the extent that Levi's not guilty, that's why you find that language of Gezerah to represent that gap over there.
Well, even the Rashbam, who says that the brothers didn't literally sell him, still says, well, they got him in the situation,
right,
in the first place.
They brought it about. So you know, there's clearly, and that's, you know, it's also itself a whole discussion. It's part of what's in the news this week about different legal questions, about where do you go back to the original causing of a situation, where do you assign guilt, or do you look at the mice itself. It's a tough question, you know, but that's a part of the whole background and the whole back and forth here. The notion of the Srim Kesef, which is mentioned here, so here the Haftorah from Amos refers to shoes, the idea that they bought shoes with this money, so that's itself an interesting reference. The Azayim Latorah, the Litzkarav, suggests that the emphasis on shoes is that they want to say that they saw him as Haruge Bezdin, they saw him as somebody who was Chayv Misa, and therefore there's no Shiva, so showing that they were wearing shoes, and that's in contrast to Reuven. Reuven tears Kriya, but the other brothers are trying to emphasize that they didn't see him as subject to Avelis. Okay, so the next pasuk tells us, V'yashur Reuven al-Habor, V'hinei in Yosef al-Habor, V'yikra es-Begadav, so here it tears Kriya, as we just mentioned. And the Medrash says that he was doing tshuva for the incident with Bila. So Soloveitchik, in the volumes that came out in the past years on these psukim, so he writes, why was he doing tshuva now specifically? He says he saw that the impact, that the disrespect that he had for Yaakov in that incident, so he saw the impact it had on the others, because now all the other brothers, so okay, so Reuven can be disrespectful, it's not a priority for us either, and now they were willing to sell Yosef, so he realized further just the impact of his behavior, and how it's always a problem that it's not just the Avera that you do, but it's the impact you have on those around you who are susceptible to your influence and will themselves then take it further. So that's what Reuven saw, and therefore he took this as a timon, as he took this as a situation where he felt that he needed to do tshuva particularly. Okay, so to continue here, so the Yashav Alachav, Vayomar hayelad enenu v'ani anani bo. So what's going on? What are we going to do? He's not here anymore. So vayichu as kusonas Yosef, vayishchatu sir izim, vayitpulu as hakusonas adam. So they shechted this goat and they dipped the coat in the blood. And Rav Soloveitchik understood that the brothers felt that they had to really destroy the coat because the coat was a symbol of the favoritism that he had, which caused the whole problem. It's noteworthy. The Gemara Masechta Shabbos tells us specifically that Yaakov deserved some blame for what happened with Yosef because of the favoritism that he showed to him and how that created a ripple effect, and therefore that's also something that has to be learned from. So they felt they had to get rid of the coat specifically. There's Nayim Torah notes also that if they want to make the case that Yosef died, this goes back to that same Gemara Nivamas, that same Aaron Nivamas around Kuf Chaf. Now we want to talk about how you can prove somebody died. So let's say you have bloody clothing. So this Nayim Torah notes that the Gemara says that normally you can't prove that a person died because of their bloody clothing, because clothing are the kind of items that sometimes people lend to someone else. So it might be that this clothing might belong to Reuben, to a different Reuben, to some random person, but he lent it to a different person. So that's true in general, but here, this specific coat that was so special, so this is not the kind of coat that Yosef was going to lend to anyone else. So that was something that could work for this, and that was his point, and that was what they were trying to do. Okay, so just to skip to the end here, just quickly. So v'yishalchu as ksonas hapasim v'yavihu hapasim v'yavihu l'avihem v'yomru zos matzanu hakir na hakusonas mincha hivlo. Look at this, do you recognize it? V'yikira v'yomar ksenus b'ni chayara achalasu taruf Paraf Yosef, oh my gosh, Yosef was destroyed. Vayikra Yaakov Simlosa, Vayasim Sak, Vamasnav, Vayisabil, Beno Yam Rabim, he went into great mourning. Vayakumu, Kolbana, Vachobanosel, Vanachmo, Vayimayim, Lehisnachem. So they all tried to comfort him, and he refused. And he wasn't able to be comforted. Vayomer, Ki Ered, El Bini, Avel, Sheola, Vayevcho, Soaviv. So he wasn't able to be comforted, and he said he's going to sink together with his son in mourning. So here, there is the notion Masechta Sofrim has that he was unconsolable, was inconsolable, and that reflects the fact also that Yosef was really still alive. And because he was still alive, that actually got in the way of him being able to receive comfort. The Torah Tamima suggests that if that's really true, so that should have tipped him off, that he should have then realized that Yosef was still alive. So Rashi notes already that he had a haftacha that he's not going to see Gehenna if none of his sons die in his lifetime, so maybe he was worried about that. But it's a question in general, just how much this is something that one could really determined based on this, that that was the reality that he was still alive, but this is the notion that Chazal have, that because he was still alive, he wasn't able to get a nechama.
I know this is sort of my own limud, sort of based on the well-known Broadway show concerning this week's Parsha.
Okay.
But is there a possibility that it just wasn't affected because they weren't really sincere? Like, they were the ones who tricked Yaakov, so how can, you know, sort of like, I killed your relative, now I'm coming to the Shiva call.
That's an interesting question, you know, that they could not do a good job of being Menachem, which gets into a fascinating discussion in general, way beyond our scope, but the whole notion of Nichum Avelim and what exactly is the process and what exactly is the responsibility upon the Menachem. Very, very interesting question. But that's an interesting note to say that because it was inherently insincere, so therefore, if you assume that the Menachemim have the responsibility of actually bringing the Nechama, and how good of a job can they do when they are both the reason for the problem and also know, maybe, assuming that they knew that he was still alive, which is also not clear. And that's subject to a lot of what we've seen already in some of these circumstances and some of these indications. But if they did know, so that adds an extra element, so then how effective of a job could they do trying to convince him that he should be comforted? So this notion that there is something that gets in the way of receiving nechama when the person is still alive, so it's a fascinating idea. And the state for Ohel Moshe, so he suggests that it's because the memory is kept alive by the fact that there's a desire of both sides to reconnect. So the family misses the person who's missing, and the person who's missing is anxious to get back to his family, and somehow on a metaphysical level, that or on a spiritual level, that creates an ongoing kesher between them, and you can't be resolved, it can't be settled, and they continue to be anguished. Rav Dessler has a little bit about this in his Sefer Michtav Melio, where he discusses, it's interesting, so we know that at a Shiva, the practice, at least among Ashkenazim, is to use the Nusach of Hamokam Minachem Etchem B'Soch Shevei L'Siyam Yerushalayim, which would mean that God should express comfort and that God should console. But the language of Hamokam, which again is not in the Gemara, it's just a practice that has developed specifically among Ashkenazim, but the choice to use Hamokam specifically as a kinoi for God in that sentence is an interesting choice, and there's a lot written about why we use that. So Rav Dessler writes that we want to counter the famous expression that people say that time heals all wounds. So Rav Dessler asserted that it's not true, that time does not heal wounds. It's not that it happens automatically. It's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu grants nechama. We refer to Ritzei on Shabbos, we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the Baal HaNechamos. He is the one who is uniquely able to confer actual comfort. So the fact that there can be ever a nechama over a loss is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore we want to contrast that don't think that time heals all wounds, doesn't happen from time. So a place is a way of saying not time, but place. But really it means HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who grants this gift. So being that it doesn't happen naturally, it happens when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is bestowing it, so then when it is lacking because the person is still alive, so then maybe there is something that cannot happen. Also on this phrase of Ayimayim Lehisnachem, that he felt that he refused to be comforted, so this is one of the themes that Rav Fisher discusses in this Rasha here in the Beis Yishai. Right. It goes in a great length about the whole theme of Mechiras Yosef and what exactly it represents and why is it that it keeps popping up in later generations, that there is an ongoing punishment and an ongoing liability for Mechiras Yosef. And he discusses there how, on one level, the real victim was Yaakov, but there was a lack of kavod showed to Yaakov, a lack of concern that Yaakov was going to suffer greatly from the story, as this pasuk indicates, that he says that he's not going to be comforted, and that this whole language of ki erid el bani avel sheola, and before that of eimayim lehisnachem, and he discusses there, it discusses at great length, but he makes the point that there are really two things that were impacting on Yaakov. One is his son's suffering, and in general, the Avera ben Adam L'Chavero that is included here, and the emphasis on how one can make such cheshbonos against somebody else's basic humanity, and that is kind of the shoresh of all other Averas ben Adam L'Chavero, and that was a painful thing to Yaakov. But also what this was an unsuccessful attempt to do was to wipe out one of the Shvatim, really two of the Shvatim, because he later ends up splitting into two, but at least one of the Shvatim to be wiped out. So this was an offense against the whole future legacy that was guaranteed or was expected of Yaakov's children. So there's that two-pronged issue here, one, the massive Ben Adam L'Chavero Avera, and it's worth noting also there's so many different elements that come into this. If we do look at this, like we mentioned before, is the paradigmatic Avera ben Adam L'Chavero, the whole notion of justification and rationalization and everything that comes along with how people decide to hurt each other. So that's very much a theme here and very much a part of what needs to be the lesson. So all of that is here, and this is all part of why this Avera had so much impact, the Avera ben Adam l'Chavera component, and also the attempt to wipe out one of the Shvatim. So both of those are contained in this, and that's part of what's reflected in this pasuk. I'll just end with one more note about this whole episode. Rabbeinu Bachya quotes from Yerushalmi, Shkalim, if I remember correctly, that there is a theme that Pidgin HaBen, the mitzvah of Pidgin HaBen, is a atonement for Mechiras Yosef. So the Meshech Chachma points out that that seems pretty strange, because what that means is that if this is all supposed to be a kapara for the Zaver against Yosef, so what could happen is, or the only kind of ways that would happen is, let's say you have a descendant of Yosef who has a firstborn, so he is going to have to be poda, the firstborn, by paying money to a descendant of Levi. So that means that the victim is going to have to pay money to one of the perpetrators. So we discussed a few minutes ago how much Levi was a part of it. Okay, but let's say, assuming he was a part of it, so that doesn't seem like much of a kapara. So Yosef was the victim, and Levi was the perpetrator, one of them. So Pidgin HaBen, descendant of Yosef, is going to have to pay a descendant of Levi. How does that work? So he thought that was pretty astonishing. So I wonder if maybe we could suggest that the notion of Pidgin HaBen as a kapara, so it doesn't mean that this is meant to pay back. It's not reparations in that sense. But perhaps what it means is that we go through this process as a way of reversing our mindset and reversing our attitudes. And the question at the core is, if you have somebody who's destined for a great future, so how do you relate to that? There's somebody among you who's destined for greatness, so what reaction does that bring out from you? So the brothers of Yosef, they saw that as a threat, and they decided they have to get rid of him. And the message of Pidgin HaBen is the opposite, that here you have this firstborn who's destined for service in the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and the father has to show how much he wants to hold on to him and has to pay money in order to keep him, so to speak. Not that there really was an alternative choice, but the Nusach, the Pidgin HaBen, the Kohen actually says, what do you want more? So we show that we value this child who is destined for greatness and want to hold on to him. So in a sense, that is a reversal of the attitude of Mechiras Yosef, and maybe that's what we mean when we say that it is a atonement. So in that sense, it's also reflective on the whole theme of Averis ben Adam l'Chavero, and where they can start from a lack of fully valuing and fully appreciating another, and not seeing their success as your success, but rather their success as your threat. And that's also a part of the whole mentality of considering what Ben Adam l'Chavero paths can go wrong and how to fix them. And of course, just to end, we'll note that the basic appreciation for the presence of others in our lives, as opposed to seeing them as a threat, but rather seeing them as a bracha, as a blessing, and as a potential for good, that's one of the messages of Hakar Satov overall. And we are fortunate that in this country there is a day dedicated to the theme of Hakar Satov. And tomorrow we should have that in mind throughout, that the first, many of the Rishonim understood that the most basic principle of Avodas Hashem is first to acknowledge Hakar Satov. And so we have a weekend devoted to that. We have first tomorrow's national holiday, and then by Sunday night we have a Yantif, that we have a festival that is devoted to the theme of Hodah, of Hakar Satov. So recognizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has provided us with so much, including all the people who are in our lives, who we are grateful for, and who we're careful to treat properly, and to see them as the blessings that they are. So with that note, I wish you a wonderful longish weekend. Looking forward to seeing you on Sunday, and we should know only good things and be grateful for them.